Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane.
And I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder. One of the four beasts saying, "Come and see." And I saw, and behold, a white horse.
That is Johnny Cash quoting from the book of Revelation in the song When the Man Comes Around, the final chapter in the Bible with its vivid imagery of death, destruction, and salvation has inspired and terrified for almost 2,000 years, and noted religion scholar Elaine Pagels calls it the strangest book in the Bible. Elaine Pagels is a best-selling author and a professor of religion at Princeton University, and she joins us today on Radio Times. Elaine Pagels, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
And I have to say, I've heard this song, When the Man Comes Around, so many times, but every time I hear that, it just gives me the chills. And you had a big reaction to this as well.
Well, you know, the book of Revelation is not only strange, it's also very controversial. And as you said, it's very powerful. And so many people have made songs and paintings and art and films because they're so compelled by this imagery.
What drew you to this book?
Well, many things. One of them is that this is the most controversial book, and the question of how did it ever get into the Bible when it was debated from the very beginning. Some people loved it, and some people didn't. And that's been the case from the beginning. But I had once been, when I was about 13, in an evangelical religious group, which I joined because I loved the intensity and the passion of that group, and the people there were deeply involved in this book and the kind of convictions that come out of it. And after about a year, I left that group because they started to tell me that people we knew were going to hell because they weren't born again, and I thought, this isn't what I love about this church. So I left. But I always wanted to know, what was it about that experience with that kind of church, that kind of passion and conviction that's so powerful?
Mm-hmm. So as you set out to write your book, Revelations, how do you research a topic like this? Do you start with the text? What are your sources? Just talk about the process a little bit.
Well, first you read the book, and you know, you look
at
it, and the book of Revelation, and you say, wait a minute, there's no ethical teachings in this. There's no stories in it. All it is, this book, is visions. It reads like dreams and nightmares. So that was compelling in itself, and I thought, why would people read this for 2,000 years? It's so amazing. Then, when I was in graduate school, I came to realize, working with some scholars there, that many more books of Revelation had been written in the ancient times, that this isn't the only book. So that created a puzzle. I kept thinking, wait a minute, what are these other books of Revelation? What's in them? And why did this one get into the Bible?
And what makes it a revelation? Is it that something is revealed to a person, and of what nature?
Yes. I mean, the title, the Greek title, Apocalypsis, means the unveiling, and Revelation is just the Latin version of that. And what it suggests is that, you know, here's a person, John, who's a prophet, living on a small island off of the coast of what's now Turkey, and suddenly he sees a divine being, and he's taken up into heaven, and he sees things which are revealed to him by divine sources. That's the way these texts usually work.
And who is John of Patmos, who is believed to be the author of this book of Revelation?
That's a very contested question, because most Christians who know this book would say, well, John of Patmos was a disciple of Jesus. He was John of Zebedee. He wrote the Gospel, the fourth Gospel, the Gospel of John. However, we really don't know who wrote the book. And this author, he says his name is John. We call him John of Patmos because he wrote on that little island. He never says he's one of the disciples. He talks about the 12 disciples of Jesus as if they were somebody totally different. So he seems to be an independent prophet. And most scholars think he lived in the second generation of Jesus' followers, not one of his immediate followers.
So he did not meet Jesus?
We don't know for sure, but the chances are that he probably didn't, because he's writing about 60 years after the death of Jesus, in the year 90, just the end of the first century.
And how did one, this may be a silly question, but how did one become a prophet? Did you have to have a following? Did you have other people looking to you for answers? How did anybody take you seriously?
Well, that's a really good question. And of course, it's as contested then as it would be now. You know, you can say, well, you know, a divine being appeared to me, or God said to me, or an angel spoke to me last night. And some people may believe you and some won't. That's why some said this book was written by a heretic, and some people say, no, it was revealed by Jesus himself, who was alive after he died and appeared to John 60 years after his death.
We're talking with Elaine Pagel. She is a professor of religion at Princeton University and has written a new book about the Book of Revelation. Set the scene for us a little bit. You said that John of Patmos was living on this island. It was about 60 years he wrote this book after Jesus' death. So what was going on in his world? What might he have had experienced?
Well, the book is about conflict and war between the forces of good and the forces of evil. And it makes much more sense if we understand that it comes out of John's experience of war. Because 30 years after Jesus died, Jesus had said the kingdom of God was coming and that Jerusalem was going to be destroyed and the temple and all of this. There were dire prophecies that he made, which sounded extreme. But 30 years after Jesus' death, there was the Jewish revolution against Rome, 66 to 70, and the Romans came in and just crushed it. It's like the American Revolution, because they were fighting in the name of God and our common liberty. But the Roman troops just devastated Jerusalem, destroyed the Jewish fighters. And John was apparently a refugee from that war in Jerusalem and struggling with the question, why didn't Jesus come back and why hasn't the kingdom come?
And did that throw the followers into a real crisis as well? I mean, could Christianity kind of have ended at that point?
We see in all of the Gospels, in Luke and Matthew, people struggling with the question, well, Jesus said the kingdom of God was going to come with power within a generation. He said, some of you who are still alive will see the kingdom come with power. And 30 years or 40 years after he said that, his followers are thinking, what did he mean? Because we haven't seen it yet. So they all struggle. They reinterpret it, or they say, well, it's been delayed. But John wants to write and say, don't worry, it's still coming. It may be 60 years later, but it's going to come soon.
And his anger is visceral in his writing, his just rage almost.
The anger and the rage, you're totally right, comes out of the anguish of somebody whose people and nation have been just devastated by, you know, the brutal force of the Roman Empire, which was as brutal as any government could be when any of its subjects revolted. So he writes a kind of denunciation of Rome, but he does it as a prophet in the language of his favorite prophets, Isaiah, Daniel, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, uses their images and says, just the way Israel's ancient enemies have fallen like Babylon, now Rome is going to fall and Jesus will come back and destroy his enemies and set up a new world.
And as John writes this, he specifically addresses different groups. Who is he writing to? Who is he speaking to?
Well, that's a very interesting question. It's hard to answer. He's probably writing to groups of Jesus' followers, particularly he writes to groups in what they called Asia Minor, but what is now Turkey. And so he wants to tell them two things. One of them is, don't worry, just hang on. The kingdom of God is coming. Jesus will come back and set the world right and bring divine justice. The other thing he wants to say is, and by the way, there are some prophets in our group that I don't like. They're prophesying the wrong things, and I'm the right kind of prophet. So there's a contest between prophets, even in the book.
And there are a lot of threats, like, do not assume that you will be saved, because you may not. It reads that way.
Right. The book is written as a warning. Uh-huh. It's written as a warning, and people have always read it. And there is, as you say, anger. There is also terror in many of those images.
Now, the symbolism in the book has inspired many people, like Johnny Cash. It has inspired artists. What are the symbols or what are the images that most stick out to you?
Well, there are unforgettable images that artists, from Johnny Cash to African American hymnals and William Blake and Michelangelo, have used. One of them is the great beast, which the beast is bright red, has seven heads and seven crowns on its heads, and it represents the power of a violent empire.
And seven. That number shows up many times, the seven seals and so on. What's the significance?
Well, it is a sacred number in Jewish literature, and Daniel uses it a lot. But it also, most people think, the beast with seven heads was probably understood by John to refer to the empire headed by seven emperors from the time of Augustus to his own time. And, you know, this is a kind of veiled imagistic language that you could use if you're a Jew challenging the empire, which could be very dangerous at this time. So he writes it in the veiled way that other Jews and other followers of Jesus would understand.
And maybe the best known symbol is the number 666. And you have a very interesting explanation for that in the book.
Yes, and that isn't original with me at all, because people have puzzled over this for 2,000 years. In Jewish tradition, there's a way of ascribing a numerical value to every letter. So if the letter, you know, A means this number and the letter B is that, you can figure out it with a name, a calculation of a number. And most people who work on this calculation system think that it comes out to the imperial name of Nero, who many people just thought was the epitome of all the worst emperors. So he seems to be the symbol of all evil.
And Nero was specifically persecuting Christians or followers of
Jesus.
He
did. Yes, he did. And also you have an image, like John will say in the book of Revelation, that I saw a great mountain explode, and it polluted the sea, and it clouded the air, and the fish all died. That's probably referring to the explosion of Mount Vesuvius in the year 79, which is about 10 years before he writes. Many people took that as a sign that the end was near.
So you see this book more as commentary on what is happening now in the world of John, rather than a vision for what's next?
What I was doing was looking at it historically and saying, what do we think John has in mind immediately? And that's pretty interesting in itself, but what's also fascinated me here, and I didn't want to stop with that and just say, hey, this is a book about the first century. It's become a book about 2,000 years and a current book, because the images are so open-ended that you can read any conflict, almost any political, social, any war in terms of this same imagery of the forces of good against the forces of evil.
And we're coming up on a break, but before we get to that, I wanted to introduce the very powerful image of the whore. And how do you explain that, or how do you see that?
Yes, the image of the whore of Babylon comes out of the book of Isaiah. And Isaiah talks about Babylon because this is the empire that destroyed Israel in the 6th century BCE. The Babylonian empires conquered Israel, and the soldiers destroyed the temple. And so he says, Babylon, Babylon, who cares about Babylon? Babylon is just a huge, rich whore who thinks she can rule everything, but she's going to be brought down.
That's Elaine Pagels. She's a professor of religion at Princeton and has a new book about the book of Revelation. We'll talk more in a moment. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moskowain, and this is Radio Times.
The Keystone Honors Academy at Cheney University supports WHYY. The Keystone Honors Academy offers competitive academic scholarships to undergraduate students, lessening the burden of attaining a quality college education. The Keystone Honors Scholarship provides eligible students with tuition, laptop, room, board, and fees, as well as a living learning community that nurtures growth and development. To learn more, 610-399-2386 or cheney.edu.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life, and I'm excited to announce that I'm coming to Princeton, New Jersey to give a talk about how we put together a radio show each week. I'll be playing clips and favorite stories, and I can basically mix the show on stage live as you watch. And unlike some other public radio hosts, I do not sing. It'll be Sunday, April 29th, 3 in the afternoon at the MacArthur Theater in Princeton. Proceeds benefit WHYY. For more information, visit whyy.org/member experience.
Walk MS supports WHYY. Research shows that one out of two local residents know someone living with multiple sclerosis. That someone, your sister, coworker, or even that neighbor who insists on cheering for the Yankees, needs your help. Walk MS is changing the lives of the thousands of local someones affected by MS. More at 800-883-WALK or walkforms.org. That's walkforms.org for the Walk MS coming this spring in a community near you.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moscowane.
Well, who's that riding?
Johnny Revelator.
Who's that riding?
Johnny Revelator.
Who's that riding?
Johnny Revelator.
Hey, book of the seven, tell me what's Johnny riding?
Master Revelator.
What's Johnny riding? What's Johnny riding?
And that's a 1930 recording of Blind Willie Johnson and wife singing John the Revelator. And we're talking about the Book of Revelations today. Our guest is Elaine Pagel. She's a professor of religion at Princeton University. And her latest book is Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. And Professor Pagels, before our break, we talked a bit about that some of this book is certainly commentary on what was happening in the author John of Patmos, his life at the time. But then a lot of it looks forward to kind of the future of this movement, which wasn't called Christianity then. So he's kind of trying to see what is next, in a way.
Well, yes, that's what the divine, you know, Son of Man who appears to John says he's going to tell him what must happen next. So it is about the end of the world, and that's why the book has lived for centuries in a very powerful way in the lives of so many people, and still does.
And what were John's concerns about how this, it was a sect back then, was shaping up, and who should qualify for being a follower of Jesus?
Well, his main concern was that it was dangerous to be a follower of Jesus, that because Jesus had been crucified by the Romans for sedition against Rome, his followers were considered suspect. They were being arrested, they were being tortured, they were being executed, like Peter was crucified and Paul was beheaded and so forth. So it was dangerous to be a Christian, and these people were suffering terribly, as his people had in the war. So that's one reason why John was passionately concerned about, when will God come and set it right? How long is God going to tolerate injustice on earth? And that's why someone like Blind Willie Johnson and other people who suffered oppression in this country, for example, and many others, suffered violence and brutality, heard this message of John as a message about God's going to come and restore justice to the earth and set everything right and punish the people who are violating us, and raise up the lowly. And that's a message that people still find in it.
So it's a message of hope, clearly.
It is. I mean, many people have found in it. I was thinking, you know, Martin Luther King famously repeated the saying that the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Well, this book, for people who are understanding that kind of oppression happening to them, is a book about justice.
In your book, you also describe, though, that John had worries about who was a follower of this belief and who should be and how should they behave. So what was he concerned about there?
Well, he seems to have been somebody who was immersed in the Hebrew prophecies. You know, you have to realize that John of Patmos probably didn't read what we call the New Testament because it hadn't been assembled yet. He certainly didn't think his book would be part of it, because his scripture was the Hebrew Bible. And he was intent on God's people Israel, of which he considered himself a proud member, was going to be holy for God. And people should eat the right food, which probably meant kosher food. They should be careful about their behavior. And he felt that there were some people teaching Jesus' followers that it was all right to eat ordinary food that Gentiles ate, or engage in sexual practices that John disapproved of. So he saw the writings of someone like Paul of Tarsus leading people into a different direction.
And was he concerned about non-Jews joining in?
Well, apparently so, because he lives in a world that is the world of God's people who found the Messiah. And he lives on the cusp of a huge change when Gentiles will start flooding into the movement. And I think John is saying, but wait a minute, they're not holy. They're not observing what we have to observe to be a holy people. And so what would become Christianity was something, of course, he didn't envision in the way that we now do.
We have some people who want to join the conversation already at 1-888-477-9499, and I want to invite other people in on the conversation as well if you have a question or a comment about the Book of Revelation and want to talk to Professor Elaine Pagels. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. How did this writing end up in the Bible? Was it controversial? You said it was controversial right from the start.
Yes, some people said it was written by a heretic because there was a prophecy movement. You asked about how does a prophet legitimize the prophecy? Well, that's a big question then. There was a charismatic prophecy movement about 70 years after John wrote, and those prophets, some of them women, used the Book of Revelation, and they loved the Book of Revelation. They said, look, it's coming soon. Jesus is coming, the New Jerusalem. And their critics said, that book, it's written by a heretic. And so others said, no, it's written by John. And later, it was highly contested. So some people wrote up lists of the New Testament, what should be in it. Most of them left this book out.
And who was the biggest proponent for putting it in?
The Bishop of Egypt, Athanasius, who was himself an enormously controversial person, wanted to put it in. And one of the reasons, I think, is because at the end, John says, you know, that these are the words of the Lord. Don't add or subtract to this. And he meant it to apply to his list. So it's fascinating. I also think that people trying to establish the Orthodox Church in the 4th century after the empire is Christian, the governor and the emperor is a Christian, we're trying to say the people who go into the lake of fire are not just Romans and, you know, our oppressors, but they are heretics. And the people who go into the heavenly Jerusalem are Christians in our community.
So this book has continuously served as somewhat of carrot and stick as well, because people have interpreted it differently to both inspire hope and fear.
Yes, it's been read by, for example, Catholics and Protestants against one another intensely. It's read by Christian groups against each other. So you can read it in many different contexts just because the images are so amazing.
We have a lot of people who want to join our conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Let's start with Michael. He's joining us from Bristol. Hi, Michael. You're on Radio Times.
Hello, Megan. Hello, Dr. Pagels.
Hi.
I'm wondering, since there were and are Christian reincarnationists, and they have a different view of that afterlife than the Day of Judgment and Resurrection and the dead and such, don't they believe that the Gnostic, I'm sorry, I read the Central Gnostic Gospels, don't they believe that the Book of Revelation is itself false because they believe most or everyone is eventually saved in some future life?
Thank you, Michael. I'm going to pass that
That's a great question. And that's one of the things that really struck me when I was working on this book is that, as you say, this is one Book of Revelation, but many other books of Revelation that are suppressed have a universal view of human beings. The Book of Revelation moves entirely, just as you said, toward the judgment. And, you know, some go into a lake of fire that burns forever, it says. Some go into the heavenly Jerusalem. But the other books of Revelation have this universal vision. And that was very much suppressed in the early Christian movement by people who liked that sort of divided picture of human beings. And what you say brings up that important question.
And the book always also seems at odds with the teachings of Jesus, which are very forgiving in nature. And I just thought back to my own childhood, where I basically always felt like, well, as long as you try, it's good enough and you'll go to heaven. That was my sense that I was given being brought up in a Christian home.
Well, you know, this is interesting to me because, just as the previous caller mentioned, there are different views of, you know, of the Christian message. If you look in the Gospel of Matthew in chapter 25, Jesus talks about the parable of the sheep and the goats and says, well, who goes into the kingdom of God? It's the person who feeds the hungry, clothes the naked, visits the sick and those people in prison. Those people who show compassion are the people whom Jesus invites into the kingdom. And the people who don't get invited are people who don't show compassion. So it's about specific acts. The book of Revelation is different. It says the people who go into the lake of fire, John of Patmos says, are the dogs, the filthy, the abominable, the evildoers. Now, anybody you don't like can be in that group. And that's why people on two sides of the same conflict can read this book quite different from the view of Jesus that is described in Matthew.
Is there a chance to be... I wasn't clear in reading the text in the Bible again. It seems like there's also no chance really to... If you have sinned, you can't make up for it. It's you're judged, you're done.
There seems to be no reprieve. One of the most, you know, controversial issues today among many Christians who take this book seriously is it really true that God would throw human beings into torment forever?
For sinning once, maybe.
Or whatever. I mean, that there's no possible, as you said, there's no compassion, there's no forgiveness in that.
And our caller, Michael, thank you, by the way, Michael, for calling in. Our caller, Michael, brought up the Gnostic Gospels, which are other texts that have not been included in the Bible that you obviously are very familiar with, have written on, and have written a best-selling book about. So what are some other revelations that you talk about in your new book?
This is what struck me, and I didn't write about it in the Gnostic Gospels, but there are revelation texts that were found with them. One of them, believe it or not, is called the Secret Revelation of John. And in the Secret Revelation of John, John says to the divine Jesus, will everyone live in the pure light? And Jesus says, yes, because the Spirit speaks to everyone. That book is a universal book. It's about, you know, you can't even stand up if you don't have the Spirit of God. And it says only people who, you know, there the idea is that almost everyone will come to unity with each other and with God at the end.
And as a scholar of religion, how do you struggle with the issue of authenticity when we're reading this book of Revelation? It has been translated and copied, and how does that come into play when you think about this book and the person who wrote it?
Well, I think there are two ways to think about authenticity. One is, did someone named John of Patmos really write it in the first century? And I think most everybody who reads it would say, yes, the language is consistent and it's an authentically ancient book. But if you're talking about spiritual truth, that's a question that I think really we ought to think about. Because that, some people will say, well, the church tells me what's spiritually true. But some of these other texts suggest that one has to have a sense internally, and that we have the capacity to judge spiritual truth. And that's a very important question.
We have another caller on the line. Doris is joining us from Mount Airy. Hi, Doris. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
Yeah, listen, I'm just listening, and I just wanted to kind of say a couple of things real quick, because I was curious as to what, when I'm listening to what you're saying, and the first thing that came to my mind was, I'm wondering what her belief system is, what her perspective is from how she's viewing, not just the book of Revelation, but the Bible, but since you're focusing on that. And the other thing, and like I said, I can take my answer off the air, but the other thing I wanted to make a comment about is this. This is a very interesting and sensitive subject for a lot of people, just the Bible in total. But the one thing that I guess people need to think about, because I notice in a way you're kind of questioning what it says. Like, we know the scripture tells us, John, that the revelation was given to John. he was a disciple of Christ. If you look at world history in terms of what you're reading and what you see happening in the world, if you just track world history and take the Bible out of it and see that everything that was predicted in Scripture and prophecy up to this point in human history has come true with 100% accuracy. And you take the four empires that are mentioned in the Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. And those four, of course, are in there only because they are the nations that subjected the Jews. The Jews were under their subjection. But all I'm saying is this, that we have to look at, in the same way that people are tired of hearing about the Israelis and the Palestinians, you have to, when it comes to the issue of the Bible, it has to be viewed differently than the secular issues in the world. And I guess I would say, from my perspective, God has given us what he wants us to know in Scripture. And you mentioned Revelation. We're not to add to or take anything away from it.
Okay, Doris, I'm going to stop you right there because you bring up so many issues, and I want to give Professor Pagels a chance to respond here.
This is a really important point, and it's true that if you go to church or if you go to a religious seminary, you go to hear how the church has interpreted the Bible throughout time. Because I teach at a university, I mean, I was very interested in the questions you raise about how do we take the Bible? Can we ask questions? Can we choose some things and not other things? And when I do historical work, you know, that is what we do. We ask those kinds of questions. And what's authentic and, you know, what do you believe? That's quite different from the religious perspective that you speak about, which is the way many people approach the book. And that's what makes it precisely, as you say, a very sensitive subject.
And she also asked, Doris also asked about your own faith background.
Yes. Well, I'm a Christian. I go to a church in Princeton, in Trinity Church. But it is one that looks at many different interpretations. You see, Doris, the thing is, when you have other early Christian texts that we never knew about before, they raise questions about, you know, what we do have in the New Testament and how it was put there. At least they raise those questions for me.
When was the Bible as we know it today put together?
What, that's a fascinating thing, you see, because we didn't have a New Testament. That is, the early Christian movement lived without a New Testament for nearly 400 years. And Christians would use, in those before that time, some gospels. Some read the Gospel of Matthew a lot. Some read the Gospel of John particularly. Some followed Paul. Some loved John of Patmos and his revelation. So what we see is that the movement could survive with many different kinds of sources. It's only in the 4th century that we had a New Testament and had them all put together. And then people are under pressure to say, well, John of Patmos's book agrees with Matthew. But actually, when you look at them the way a historian has to, they're somewhat different.
And before we go to break, what was the impetus in making, in having a book and in kind of organizing the movement more?
Well, that only happened when, to everyone's surprise, Emperor Constantine became a Christian himself and started to become the patron of the Christian church, and he wanted a Bible with all the right things in it. So it was he and the bishops with him of what they called then the Catholic Church. They meant the Universal Church, the largest group, who struggled about what should be in and what shouldn't be.
Our guest is Elaine Pagel. She is professor of religion at Princeton University and a best-selling author. She has written The Gnostic Gospels and The Origins of Satan, and her latest book is Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. We'll talk more after our break. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane, and this is Radio Times.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Orchestra, under James Conlon, performs one of Mozart's final symphonies, No. 38, The Prague. These concerts of musical postcards from Prague also feature Dvorak's 7th Symphony. Mozart tickets at philorc.org or phone 215-893-1999. March 22nd, 23rd, and 24th at the Kimmel Center, Music from Prague, Dvorak and Mozart, with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. As a Mormon candidate makes his way through the states, we'll take a look at one aspect of Mormon life that the military is studying to try to learn from, food storage. Also, we'll spin a few mixtapes with the San Francisco Mixtape Society. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY. Studio Incaminati, School for Contemporary Realist Art, supports WHYY and presents Open House March 24th and 25th. Accomplished artists perform live model painting demonstrations, provide portfolio reviews, and guided tours. They will also explain how the acclaimed innovative curriculum fuses time-honored techniques with a modern sensibility. Information on scholarships, full and part-time programs, drawing and painting classes at 215-592-7910 or studioincaminati.org.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about the Book of Revelation with religion scholar Elaine Pagels. She's the Harrington Spear Payne Foundation Professor of Religion at Princeton University, and her latest book is Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. And Elaine Pagels, before we started, you told me that this book is actually also going to be on the New York Times bestseller list.
It just went on to the bestseller list this week, yes.
So this is it really is a topic that continues to strike a nerve with people.
It does, because this is a very powerful book, the way it's written. And it's always been one of the most popular and powerful books in the canon.
Where does this book, in which denominations of the Christian faith, does this book play the biggest role today?
That's a good question. I would think in many Protestant churches throughout the world, Pentecostal and Baptist and many other churches. But there are also groups in almost any denomination that use it a great deal and some that don't use it at all. I know that there are Roman Catholics who read it. In Orthodox churches like Greek Orthodox, Ethiopian Orthodox, Coptic Orthodox, it's never read in public. So there's an enormous disparity because the conflicts about this book continue.
And do you think a lot of Christians struggle with this issue? Is it a forgiving God or not a forgiving God? And how will it all end?
I do think many people raise the question you do, because if they read the New Testament, they see Jesus talking about love and forgiveness, and they see this book, John is concerned with justice on earth and really vengeance for the people who have crucified Jesus and persecuted his followers.
Now, we had a caller earlier who said everything that was predicted in the Book of Revelation has happened. But to many people living in the past 2,000 years, it may have not seemed like the book was coming true. But yet the book has stayed with us. So how did people kind of justify having it?
Because the images are so vivid, for example, the image of the beast who represents a great, violent, military, political power, people have read the beast not only as Nero, which John may have had specifically in mind, but they said, well, it applies to Hitler. It applies to, some people thought, to Abraham Lincoln on the Confederate side, and people on the Northern side in the Civil War said, this terrible carnage of the war is so awful, this must be the battle of the end time and the punishment of God for the sin of slavery. So they read it the opposite way. You get the battle hymn of the Republic written on the Union side. And in almost every war, people on both sides can read this book and read those images. So you can see the prophecies fulfilled if you agree with that interpretation.
Now, I have a mental health background in my other work, and as I was looking through the Bible, I was wondering about the issue of post-traumatic stress and the vivid images that must have been in John's head. I was thinking about him as a person and what kind of experience he must have had to even be able to imagine all that he writes about.
Well, it does make sense to me that this man has seen the horrors of a terrible war and people slaughtered and sort of mercilessly raped and robbed and left a whole country left as a wasteland. I mean, we see that today. And he saw that in his own country. If you go to Jerusalem today, you can still see the ruins of the Great Temple of Jerusalem, where Roman soldiers destroyed it and threw the stones down, enormous stones, the whole center of the city destroyed. You can still see that rubble today.
Do we know anything about what happened to John?
We don't. We don't. There were later legends that he was himself martyred, but that seems unlikely. I think we'd have other accounts if that had happened.
Let's get another call in. We have Bill joining us from Cape May at 1-888-477-9499. Hello, Bill. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning. Would you say there's any thought that the whole book of Revelation is about the Roman-Jewish war of A.D. 66 to A.D. 70? Because you're saying the book of Revelation was written in 95, but there's a lot of scholarly evidence that it was written in the mid-60s. Because the temple was still standing, and in Revelation 17, verse 10, mm-hmm. we still have a picture of Nero. Revelation 17, verse 10 talks about the king that is.
Yes.
And it seems like the book of Revelation can be harmonized with Jesus' prophecy sermon at Olivet, Matthew 24, Luke 21. Mm-hmm. Everything ties into the end or the fall of the old Mosaic system in 70 A.D. Everything is about first century events, and it culminated at the end of the age event, 70 A.D., the fall of Jerusalem.
All right, Bill.
And maybe the book of Revelation is cryptic, but it ties in entirely with the rest of the New Testament and its amazing sense of imminence.
Okay. I think you're absolutely right about that, and historians would agree. The question of when it was written is a tough one, and you raise that issue. One of my colleagues, John Marshall, who teaches in Canada, has written a book, and he said it was written in the year 68. He says it was written in the middle of war. Now, it could have been. We can't really tell. I mean, you talk about the earlier date, and it certainly is about the destruction of the temple and the Jewish war. I sort of went with a later date because I was thinking many people who go through war don't write about it at the time. They write about it 20 or 30 years later, the way we saw about the Vietnam War. Books came out in the 1880s and 90s about Vietnam. And so I think you're right, it is about that war. The question of when the book was written is one that really isn't solved. The date you suggest is certainly a possible one, and many scholars go with that.
Let's get another caller. Thank you so much, Bill, and let's get another caller in. We have Michael on the line. Hi, Michael. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hello.
Dr. Payne, I really love your work. I'm glad to be speaking with you.
Thank you.
I've got a question. As you were saying earlier, some of the fantastical imagery that's in Revelation is clearly purely symbolic. So when John says that there is a beast with seven heads, it's not that he really thought that there was or was going to be, you know, this fantastical creature with seven heads walking down the streets in Jerusalem, but rather that, you know, there was a horrible empire that had seven emperors and so forth, and this was just a figurative way of talking about it. Whereas, presumably, he really genuinely did anticipate that Jesus was literally going to come down from the skies, and maybe literally with a sword coming out of his mouth, and that there really was going to be a new heaven, a new earth, and a literal new Jerusalem. So there's all this fantastical imagery, and there's angels and trumpets and so forth. How much do you think was intended as code, and how much do you think was intended as this is fantastical imagery, but he really does think something like this is literally going to happen?
That's a great question, and it's almost impossible to answer, I think, because, as you say, the beast is image that you find in Daniel's prophecy for the other empires, as a previous caller pointed out. And it is certainly meant symbolically, and maybe it's because it was dangerous to speak against the empire, as I mentioned. But he does seem to think that Jesus is going to come down, and there will be a terrible war. And you know, John speaks of a pile of corpses of all of the people who die in that war, eaten by the vultures. That's the final banquet he sees at the end. And what you talk about is exactly what split Christians from the second century to the fourth century. How literally to take it? Is it meant to be that Jesus will come and rule in Jerusalem as a king in Jerusalem? That's what the book says. And Christians like Justin Martyr and Irenaeus and other fathers of the church took it that way. As Brian Daly, a scholar at Notre Dame, writes, he calls it in his book, The Hope of the Early Church. And others took it symbolically, especially commentators in Egypt, read it in a very different way, but it was exactly the question you raise.
And I had a question, Elaine. How important is the return of Jesus in today's Christian teachings? Is it more that those who are faithful go to him when they die, they go up to heaven? Or is it still very important that he will come back?
Well, there are, of course, many different views of that. And many Christians talk about the rapture, which they read in 1 Thessalonians. Actually, it's not in the book of Revelation per se. It's read into it by Christians, American Christians, from the beginning of the 20th century. But the idea there is that will, you know, well-intentioned Christians have to live through the suffering of the end time? And some said, no, Jesus will come and he will take his own with him before the end time, and he will return that way. And as you know, many people still anticipate that. And many others will say there are different views in the New Testament.
What's the vision of end time in other major religions?
That's a very good question. There are apocalyptic visions in Jewish sources. We have another revelation called the Revelation of Ezra, written about the same time, which is written by a Jewish prophet who's not a follower of Jesus. And he says, at the end time, God will judge the living and the dead. He will send the righteous into his kingdom, and he will send the evil into torment, and the Messiah will come, although that author doesn't think the Messiah is Jesus. And others, the universal revelations, have a vision that at the end there will be a glorious reunion of all beings with God.
And what do you make of the placement of this chapter as the kind of capstone for the Bible? Is it the grand finale, or how was it intended?
Well, we don't know how it's intended, but we can see how it's used. You know, if you walk out of many churches in Europe, for example, I'm thinking of Italy and Spain, you walk out the back door, or the church in the Vatican with Michelangelo's painting of the Last Judgment, often the last scene you will see is the judge, the judgment of the righteous and the wicked. And you're supposed to remember as you walk out that you have that choice. And that's a question that you have to think about. And it serves as a warning to people to stay within the Christian faith.
And we have talked, you just said that visual image of walking out, and we've talked a bit about how this book has inspired so many artists. The cover on your book, can you describe that a little bit for us? It's a very vivid image of an angel.
It's a vivid image of the angel Michael, the archangel, protector of Israel, with a sword and his foot on the head of Satan, the evil angel, because this book is all about spiritual warfare. And that's the way it's been read into people's lives, as sort of the forces of the angels against the forces of the other side, the evil side.
And we've had, especially this year, a lot of people have been talking about the end of the world. So maybe is that why this book continues to be so important, even though, of course, this time around, the end of the world has nothing to do with the Christian faith, but people are talking about it.
Well, I think it is the stress and conflict we see in the world that leads many people to say, I wish we understood what's happening, and I wish we had some assurance that things will turn out all right. And this book does speak to that, because John's conviction shines through this book, even when it's most terrifying.
And how do you see the book now that you've spent so much time with it? You had a reaction to it when you were young, and it caused you some pain, I guess, in your own faith. So how do you view it now?
I see it as a very powerful and remarkable book. I can't take one simple interpretation of it, because I can see so many. And I think, for me, it's best to read it in the context of other books of Revelation.
And what kind of reaction have you gotten for the book from your peers, from other scholars, and from people who are Christians?
Most of the reaction has been very positive, but I expect it will be, you know, of all kinds, because this book arouses an enormous range of reactions.
And your peers, what do they say? Is it controversial at all, what you're saying?
Some of it is. I mean, the scholarly work is something that's well known among scholars. And so I think there are details that one can argue about. And you've heard on the issues that have come up today that there are many issues in which one can take different sides. And scholars, of course, often do that. But I think the book is remarkable, and we do need to understand not only about this book, but how it's being read even today.
And which of the images sticks with you the most?
Well, I guess it's the one that everything leads up to, which is the image of the final judgment and the descent of the New Jerusalem.
And what does that look like in your imagination?
Well, it's quite a glorious picture. I mean, even when you go to Jerusalem today, you can see why they call it Jerusalem the Golden, because when the sun shines on the hills there, you see a vision of Jerusalem that's inspired Jews and Christians for thousands of years.
And it's a peaceful vision.
Well, one hopes.
And what's next for you before we have to go? What is next for you? What do you want to study next?
I think what really engages me is how the Bible has been read, what our caller talked about today. How do you read the Bible? That's a tough question when you look at the way it's been read for 2,000 years. A book doesn't survive, or a collection of books doesn't survive 2,000 years unless it's read by many people in many situations in different ways.
So you want to continue to engage people in conversations?
I think we can have an enormous number of conversations. This book involves questions as well as answers, as you well can see.
And with that, we're going to have to close. That's Elaine Pagel. She is professor of religion at Princeton University, and her new book is Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. It's been a pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you so much.
And thanks also to all of our callers who joined us today, and sorry to the ones we couldn't get to. I'm Maiken Scott, in for Marty Moskowain, and to end today's show, let's hear a little bit more from Johnny Cash, When the Man Comes Around.
Hear the trumpets, hear the pipers, 100 million angels singing. Multitudes are marching to the big kettle drum. Voices calling, voices crying. Some are born and some are dying. It's Alpha and Omega's kingdom come. And the whirlwind is in the thorn tree. The virgins are all trimming their wicks. The whirlwind is in the thorn tree. It's hard for thee to kick against the pricks.